This program is made possible by the friends and partners of Curator Ministries.
Well, welcome back, table listeners. You're here today with Pastor Maria Reynolds. I'm in the studio today with my man Sam and my husband Doug. Thanks for being here with me today, guys.
It's great to be here.
Well, a couple weeks ago, if you remember, Doug, when you were here, we talked about the struggle that Jacob and Esau had. Do you remember that conversation that we had? And we talked about, we just basically just kind of broke down the story of how he and his mom, with his mom's help, kind of on face value, kind of usurped his eldest brother's inheritance and blessing from their father. And just as a recap, like in the Near Eastern culture, the firstborn gets what's called a double portion. And that's literally, they get the inheritance of everything of their fathers. They then become the literally what we call the man of the household, right? They would run all the businesses. They would take care of all the people. They would be the guide to take care of everyone within the household, including any family members, servants, et cetera, et cetera. It was a very, I would say in most cases, very coveted blessing. And so the fact that this kind of got usurped, as you can tell in the story, didn't hit well with Esau. Esau was upset. Esau wanted to kill his brother. And so at the end of the story, when we spoke last, you see Jacob fleeing for his life. And so that's kind of what I want to pick up today, because I find there's some interesting bits that happen between the time that Jacob flees from his brother to the point where his life story kind of picks up with his son Joseph. That's kind of, there's a short little bit there with Jacob, but then it kind of picks up again with Joseph in the latter part of Genesis. So we find him fleeing. He's by himself, and he finds himself in this town called Bethel. It is in the Valley of Canaan, which will end up being what has been promised to Abraham and his descendants by God. So he's there. He's in Canaan. He's in this place called Bethel. He's tired. No doubt scared, very much alone. And I'm sure in this space, probably contemplating his life choices, right? So, I mean, I think about where he's at, and he's gone through all of this trouble to get this blessing, to get this inheritance, and where has it gotten him, right? So, he's alone. It doesn't say that his father sent him away with any goods. And there's a point that we'll come to when he meets Rachel later on in the story that leads you to believe he was probably broke, at least didn't have much whenever he meets her. But you've got to wonder, when he's in this space and he knows that his brother is out to kill him, like, he's got to be thinking, like, what was all this for? Do you know what I mean? And I think I've definitely been in places like that in my life, where you work so hard at something, and it really is something that you desire in your heart. And the funny thing about the story of Jacob was, what he desired, it was God ordained. God intended him to have that thing, so his desire was right. Pastor Kevin taught Wednesday night about how when you have the heart of God, when you've encountered God and God literally inhabits in you, that the desires of your heart are his desires. You were literally desiring the things that he desires. And so it makes you think that what he was desiring was right. So one of two things: either A, he didn't know that it was God's desire for him. His mother never shared that with him, because remember, in the story, only his mother had that conversation with God, and she didn't, as it's written, share it with anybody. Or he didn't trust the process in which it was going to come to him. But one of the two, you have to think, would be, why else would you manipulate that situation? Does that make sense?
Absolutely.
And I've definitely been in situations like that, where I have desired things and wanted things. My heart was pure, and I do believe it was God ordained, and worked really hard at that thing, just in the end to have failed. At surface level, feel like this has failed. Not only have I failed, but I've lost people along the way. Why? How did I get here? What was this for? Does that make sense if you've ever been there?
Oh, absolutely. There's a saying in the Greeks say that who the gods want to destroy, they first give them everything they want.
Mm. That's interesting. So I wonder if that's the headspace, and the Bible doesn't say that, but I'm just, from a humanity perspective, I wonder if that's the headspace that he's in when he reaches Bethel. And the Bible picks up and says that he, you know, you get the impression that he has a dream, right? Because he says that he encounters God as he sleeps. He puts his head in a rock and he's sleeping. And that God, you know, basically reassures him and said, listen, you know, I am God. You know, I am going to, you know, give you, I'm going to walk you through this situation. I'm going to walk you through your entire life. I'm not going to leave you alone. And I'm not going to leave you until I get you back here, because this place, Canaan, which was the promised land, this place was where you were always intended to be. This is where your descendants, this is what they will inherit. This is the inheritance, right? And so I will not leave you until I get you back here. So just rest assured, you feel alone right now, but rest assured, I am with you and I will not leave you, even if you don't see me. And I think it's interesting because I've been there where I have, you know, hindsight's 20/20. You always have the beauty of when you're a little bit seasoned to be able to look back on portions of your life. And whenever you were in those spaces of those, how did I get here moments, that you do feel very alone and felt like God's, you know, God's hand is not in this, though I thought this is where he was leading me. You have the beauty of looking back on history sometimes and seeing how he may not have been with you in that circumstance in that way, but he circled back at some point and got you right back there. Does that make sense? Has it ever happened to you?
Oh, it definitely is. I think there's many cases when God's hands are on things that you can't quite see.
Yeah. Yeah. So he has this encounter with God, and God reassures him that you're on the right path. Listen, you know, it looks bleak. I'm with you. I'm going to walk you through this thing. I'm going to need you to keep going. So remember when he left fleeing from his father's house, he left going to an area looking for his uncle Laban, basically. His uncle Laban, which was his mother's brother, if I recall. That's where they're sending him. I don't want it also to be lost, the fact that he's having to leave his father's household, which is huge. If you look at, there's only a few men in the Bible that God tells them you have to leave your father's household. Because when you leave your dad, you leave his covering, you leave everything. All resources are left behind, protection, everything is left behind. You are literally starting over on your own. You're breaking away and starting something new. And so for him to leave his father's household, in of itself, was a big deal. That wasn't something culturally that they did. And that had to be scary for him. Like, well, what do I do now? Do you know, what I mean? Like, I'm striking out of my own now. I have no resources. What do I do now? And I am completely at the mercy of finding this Uncle Laban, hoping that he opens his home to me. So you get this impression like he's kind of this vagabond a little bit, right? And he's looking, trying to find a surrogate family and a surrogate father in his uncle Laban in his household, because he's had to flee for his, which is interesting, because when you look at later on in the story with his son Joseph, that's exactly what happened with his son Joseph. He left his father's household under different circumstances, but was being sent to an area and found a surrogate father in Pharaoh, in a household. It was just interesting, the foreshadowing there, I thought anyway. So he continues sojourning, and he comes to this area, and he sees some shepherds, and a well, and he's not familiar with the territory. He doesn't know where he's at exactly. So he asks these shepherds, okay, do you know this guy named Laban? He's my kin. And like, oh yeah. There's his daughter, Rachel. Rachel also was a shepherd. And what's interesting is that, and the Bible notes this, and I'm gonna try to dig more into it and unpack it, because I'm not sure why it's there. And when you study the Bible enough, Sam, you know that when things are in a story that don't make sense, there is a reason why they're in there, and it's meant for you to kind of peel that back. Just don't glaze over like, well, that doesn't make sense. Like, go back and look at that and find out, well, what symbolism is there, whatever. But one of the things that jumped out at me the next bit was, the time of day that Rachel was coming was an odd time for people to be watering their sheep. So you had all of these men with their sheep, like, gathered around this well, and the Bible says it was a huge stone over the front of the well. And when he retched, when Joseph retched, or Jacob, excuse me, retched, the shepherds, he's kind of like, well, what are you doing? Just water your sheep. It's right here. Move the stone away, water the sheep. Like, nope, can't do it till everyone's here and Rachel's coming, which is interesting. Is also a little bit of a foreshadowing when you talk about the stone being rolled away. Mm-hmm. It also brings my mind back to the tomb where Jesus was. So there's all these different symbolisms that kind of jump out at me in that bit. He's like, oh, Rachel, is that? And then he realized he makes this connection immediately that's his cousin Rachel, whose father is Laban. And he asks, is Laban doing well? Blah blah blah. Yeah, he's good health and all that. So you jump forward to a little bit in the story, and it says that when he reaches her, he kisses her, and he starts to just like weep and cry. And so at face value, you could look at that and think, well, he's doing that because he feels like, okay, well, I've made it. Mm-hmm. Like, I've been on my own all this time, going to this place. I had no idea really the direction or where I was going to end up, hoping I got there, and I'm here. So it's almost like you feel like there's probably like a sigh of relief, like a weight lift, like, okay, well, I found some kin. I found some family. But you could also look at it a different way, because it also said that he loved her. It was almost like a love at first sight, the way that this was written. That when he saw her and he loved her, he knew that he didn't have a dowry for her, that he didn't have anything to give her to get her. Does that make sense? And so he wept. So there's a lot of rabbinic teaching around that he could have been weeping because he didn't have the goods from his household, from his father's household. Does that make sense?
That makes sense.
So anyway, she takes him to her father. And he welcomes him in with open arms, but he ends up being a surrogate father in a lot of ways, but a little bit manipulative and abusive. He strikes a deal because he doesn't have a dowry for Rachel. Work for me for 7 years and you can have my daughter. And it's interesting, the Bible says that he worked for him happily for 7 years. 7 years went away so quickly because he loved this woman. This was the only thing in his life he'd ever had that he really wanted. Like, the other stuff he wanted, like, he wanted the blessing, he wanted the inheritance, but he loved this. The other stuff he wasn't willing to work for. This he was willing to work for. I'm putting my hand to the plow. This means that much to me. Does that make sense? And so he works his 7 years, and he's like, okay, time's up, Uncle Laban, time to give me my wife. And Laban tricks him. And you know the story. He tricks him and gives him Leah, his oldest daughter, which is not who he loved. And so when he realized he's been tricked, he was like, listen, Laban, this was not the arrangement. This is not what I worked 7 years for. You know, I want Rachel. And so they broker a deal, basically, and said, I will give you Rachel now. Finish out your wedding week, and I will give you Rachel so we don't dishonor her, but then you have to work another 7 years. And it's interesting, Sam, is the latter 7 years that he worked for Rachel, he was bitter about it. And he started, like, the first 7 years, he did it nobly, but the last 7 years, some of his old characters started coming back. Because you see this where he started to, like, be very methodical in how he bred their sheep, mm-hmm. Because he would barter at the end of that for some of those sheep for his own household. Does that make sense? So he works this latter seven. He gets Rachel, he's working the latter seven. He gets Rachel, and at one point he just kind of you get the impression he just kind of had it. Like, I'm done. We're out.
Mm-hmm.
And so he doesn't do the right thing. He doesn't go back to Laban and do the honorable thing. Like, listen, we're just going to leave. I'm taking my little, you know, two wives and however many children he has at this point, and heading, you know, back to my dad's place. He, in the middle of the night, just flees. Very reminiscent of how he left his father's household looking for his surrogate family. What he doesn't know is that Rachel has stolen her father's idols. He doesn't know this. And she has them underneath her, in her pouch, on her camel. She's sitting on it. And you fast forward into the story, and Laban is coming after them. more for the idols than anything, to be honest with you. That's the kind of the picture that you get. He's upset that this has been taken from him. And so when he gets there, he confronts Jacob, and Jacob's like, "There's no, your idols aren't here, man. Search us all." And he's searching tents and he can't find them. Well, Rachel's sitting on him and she can't get up, and she makes up this lie why she can't get up, which is interesting. She's kind of a lot like her husband in that regard. And he goes as far as to say, anyone who would have your idols will die. Strike him dead, anyone who has them, because he has no clue that she has them. And remember, he loves her, the mm-hmm. only thing he's ever loved. And so Laban concedes, okay, you don't have them. They you know, make an agreement how they're going to basically live peacefully, coexisting with one another, and they move on the rest of their way. And it doesn't mention that bit again in the story, but I'm going to bring it up in the end to tell you why I think it was relevant about the idols, because again, that's one of those, Sam, it doesn't make sense. Why would you talk about idols in a satchel, her sitting on it? Why was that a big deal? When you fast forward into the story a little bit more, he has decided, I'm going to have to go back to my dad's place. Like, I have all these kids, a couple wives now, a couple concubines, and I have nowhere to go. Like, I burnt this bridge with Laban. I have nowhere else to go. I got to go back. And that's the hard part, Doug, is when you have to go back to the thing, especially once you burn bridges. And I've done that. Once I burnt bridges, had to go back to that place and hope for a reconciliation. Hope that that person that was once gunning for me has kind of cooled off. Do you know what I mean? But that's what he's having to do. And he gets word that that Esau is in this plain, in this area. And he's like, okay, here we go. And so he breaks up his household. And this is how noble the guy is, Sam, which is really how I know that not much has changed. Because you remember, and Pastor Kevin has talked about this, when you have encountered God, when you know that you've seen God in a place, like, have you ever seen God, like, you know that you've seen God at some point in your life? I don't mean God, like, in person, but I mean, you've seen the hand of God move in that place. That no one but God could have done that. Does that make sense?
Yes.
That's happened to me numerous times, so I have no doubt that God was in that place. So when that happens to you, something happens internally to you that you look at things differently. You just can't help it. And when you look at things differently, you behave differently, you act differently because you've encountered this thing, right? What's interesting to me is that he encountered God at Bethel, but he keeps reverting back to these old ways. And you hear it taught a lot, Sam, that when he encountered God at Bethel, that his life changed dramatically. And I would argue that it did not. I would argue that that is yet to come. But he divides his household up, and he's like, okay, well, here it is. I don't know the temperament of my brother. He may still be gunning for me. So here's what I'm going to do. Here's what I'm going to do, Doug. I want to have two different sets of people, right? I want to send all of my servants. They're going to go in first. I'm going to see what happens. And so whenever you go in, what I want you to say to Esau is that your brother's coming and he honors you and blah, blah, blah. Like, really, like, puff the guy up, right? And then I'm going to send in my concubines and their kids, you know, low tier. They're his kids too, but they go in first just to test the water some more. Because in his mind, it says this, in his mind, well, if he takes out all these people, at least I'll have myself. He literally ends up at the end of the story sending in all of his children, all of his wives, all of his resources. His resources, by the way, Sam, went in after his wives. That tells you something. Ahead of him, and it says he's alone again. He's alone again, and this is the point in his story where he wrestles. Remember, he says he wrestles with God. God touches his hip socket. Remember that? Well, he's alone because he sent everything ahead of him to go get potentially slaughtered mm-hmm. just to test the waters. I mean, I don't know. I would say maybe he hasn't changed much at this point. But anyway, so it says that he wrestles with God. And if you remember in the story, it says he won. He wrestled with God and won. And God at that point tells him, your name is not Jacob, it's Israel. Remember that? It's important because as you fast forward some more in the story, he goes and he meets Esau after he's wrestled with God and he's won. And he is embraced by his Esau's heart towards him has softened. It's not hardened anymore. And he is shocked, but so relieved. and then turns right around the very next chapter and deceives his brother again. Esau's like, hey, let's go to the east. And he's like, yeah, I'll meet you there, bud. And then he goes to the west. So you still see this, like, you've encountered God not once, but twice, and nothing has, not that much has changed. You keep reverting back to this old way of operating because it's what you're used to. So we fast forward just a little bit in the story after this. Now he's met with God. God has renamed him. He's met with Esau and has had this, you know, wonderful encounter with his brother. And we're back at Bethel. He meets with God again. And God reminds him, says, your name is not Jacob. Your name is Israel. And I'm like, why would you rename him? That's one of those bits, Sam. Like, well, you just named him two chapters ago. Why are we back here again? Why are we renaming him? Did you forget two chapters ago? Why would you rename him again? Because he even said, God renamed him. And then it goes on and he reminds him, he's like, I am God, you know, and he goes on to remind him who he is and how he's going to protect him and see him back to this area. All the things he told him two chapters before. So it's very repetitive to me, Doug. Why, by God, why is that there? And the very next thing that happens is he loses Rachel. So she dies in childbirth. Goes into labor, having Benjamin on the way to Bethlehem, and she dies. And that's the part that hit me. And I'm like, oh, okay. So the first time you wrestled with God and you won, the second time you wrestled with God and he won. Because sometimes when you wrestle with God and you win, winning doesn't always mean winning. Sometimes God is trying to show you things that need to change in you or in your life to protect you from some really bad things that are about to happen. And if you can't have the wisdom and the discernment and the maturity to identify that and to change those ways, then you're on this trajectory. Does that make sense? That you could have maybe derailed. I don't know. I don't know if he ever could have saved Rachel. She died in childbirth, but I can tell you this. No doubt in his mind, Doug, it came back to that thing that he said, whoever has your idols will die. Because the way he reacted to her death gives you the impression he blamed himself. Like, but for me of fleeing and behaving the way I did with Laban, I would still have this thing that I love. And sometimes that happens. Sometimes you have to lose things that you love along the way so God can win. Does that make sense?
Makes a lot of sense.
I don't know. What do you think about that?
There's one of my favorite sayings is in the movie White Men Can't Jump. There's a Mexican girl. And she kind of always says things kind of off. And she says to the Woody Harrelson character, he comes in and he had just won a bunch of money hustling basketball. And she says, sometimes when you win, you actually lose. And sometimes whenever you lose, you actually win. Mm-hmm. And sometimes whenever you tie, you don't actually win or lose. And he gets all mad and leaves. But I can always remember that. And I've repeated that. She says it in a real, like, broken English manner. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of truth to that.
Yeah. I think about, there was this lady I spoke with, it's been years ago. Her husband had been deep into addiction and had just a lot of abusive behavior, a lot of just both financially and emotionally, they'd gone through a lot as a couple. And he had went through recovery and was doing really, really well. And all the things that she wanted out of this man, she was finally getting. Like, he finally was open to a relationship with God and being the head of their household, and they had three children, and everything that she'd always wanted, she was finally getting. And she was like, you know, through the season of walking life out with him through addiction, she would say, I saw glimmers of change at times, but it never sustained. He would always relapse and go back to his old ways. But that this time, like, you know, it was sticking. It seemed like there was genuinely something changed in him, and she was so encouraged. And then something unforeseen happened out of the blue, you could say. He ended up catching a charge for something he had done years ago while living in addiction. And I remember talking to her and her saying, this doesn't seem fair. You know, we're finally on this right path. Why would God do this now? You know what I mean? And she's like, if this would have happened when he was in addiction, I'd be like, throw away the key, I don't care. She goes, but now my heart is like softened towards him. And I finally feel like I'm winning, and now it feels like I'm losing. She said, sometimes when you win, you really lose. And I said, and I was honest with her. I was like, well, let me ask you this. You said that all the times when you're walking out this addiction with him, you see these glimmers of change for much shorter periods of time. And when I say that this man had changed, I do believe it in this space. I had been around this man. There was something different about him this time. I do believe he had actually had an encounter at Bethel with God and had actually changed. But I said, let me ask you this. If you could see these charges kicked and he would walk, but know that in 6 months he would revert back to old behavior, would you be okay with that? Or if he had to serve a year, but you knew that this new man that you had would stick, would you be okay with that? And she was like, well, I don't know. And so whenever I was thinking about this with Rachel or you know, and Jacob, it reminded me of that story. Like, you know, sometimes when you win, it does seem like you're losing. And sometimes when you're losing, you're really winning. And I don't know, it's just, I thought it was just an interesting bit of his story I'd always kind of glazed over. And I can definitely see parts of myself in that story where I know that God repeatedly has worked with me and still is. He will show me something about myself, or he will show me something. We had a conversation about this past week. There was something that came up in our life, and I'm like, okay, this is a warning shot, Doug. We're going to have to circle the wagons tighter. Do you know what I mean? But if you don't pay attention to the warning shots that God gives you and actually make a change, you're just wrestling God with winning in that moment, but in the end, you may actually end up losing something that you love. Does that make sense?
Absolutely.
Anyway, got anything else?
No.
No more words of wisdom?
No more words of
nuggets
wisdom.
Nuggets of information? All right, well, table listeners, as always, we appreciate your time, and we will see you next week.
We hope you are enjoying today's show. We believe that God has given us a voice to impact communities and regions all over the world. If you would like to make sure that voice is heard, please partner with us today by visiting www.expressionradio.org and click donate. You can also text give by texting the dollar amount followed by the word radio to the number 84321. First-time text givers, please choose Expression Church of Huntington when prompted. All gifts are tax deductible. Join us as we change the world.